Well, hello to what we might call the Christmas edition of Moments That Rock, brought to you via the Pantheon Group of Podcasts. My name's Tony Michaelides, I'm the host. I'd like to wish you all a very happy Christmas and prosperous New Year. But then again, you might be listening to this in the middle of June, who knows. But anyway, have a good time. I won't tell you who this is, other than she's a splendid lady. She interviewed me on her travel podcast about a year ago. And why would I have her back? Because she spent some time within the music industry. I won't introduce her because I let them do their own introductions.
Hi, I'm Lisa Francescan and I'm a journalist and host of the Big Travel Podcast.
So, briefly, tell us your music history, Lisa, and how you got involved in live entertainment and stuff and things, and really share moments that rocks your world.
Well, I always wanted to work in music. You could say that I'm a failed musician, and I'm also a failed person who works in music because I haven't worked directly in music for a while now. So I've just failed at everything. I mean, I have become a journalist and, you know, worked with some very high profile people, including musicians. But my brother took on the music playing mantle when we were kids. And on our way down to Spain, when I was 7 years old, our parents took us to live in Spain. And on our way down to Spain, my brother was given an acoustic guitar, and he became a very prolific and well-known in his field guitarist. But we did have this magical childhood in Spain where I was performing. So I was on stage singing and dancing and acting, and he was playing in like all these cool bands and stuff around the town. So we had this really, for a tiny little town in Spain growing up, it's a town called Fuengirola, we had this incredible live music scene with loads of rock and guitar and drummers and just bars everywhere with great music. So I was always really, really exposed to that. And then on top of that, I was getting my own sort of pop music influences coming through from the UK until I was about sort of like 13 or something. And then I discovered the 60s and I just went all in into, you know, 60s hippiedom, psychedelia, got obsessed with like bands like The Doors. And I tell you what, when you're growing up in southern Spain and it's really sunny, those sort of those Californian sounds from the 60s are absolutely perfect for an 80s, late 80s child.
Yeah, you don't look old enough.
No, well, I'm not old enough, but that was, you know, I was growing up in the 80s. But those California sounds coming from the 60s really translated well to Andalusia in the 1980s and early 1990s, when we had these incredible beachy lifestyles and, you know, music to go to in bars every night, and everyone had motorbikes, and it translated really well. So that became my preferred musical era. It is wonderful. And whenever I go to LA to visit my brother, I really, you know, feel that musical history. And in fact, when I came to live in the UK, I just turned 16 and I moved to Brighton. And I felt it here as well. And I think that's what I really love about Brighton and London, and indeed places like Manchester and Liverpool, you know, those British cities where music is made, you know, history is made in terms of popular culture and music. And I came here as a wide-eyed sort of 15, 16-year-old, having grown up, you know, almost barefoot on the Costa del Sol, listening to all this rock. And I came here and it was the most magical place of, you know, just to know that, you know, bands like The Who, you know, in particular that association with Brighton, and walking down the road and seeing, like, you know, the Quadrophenia Passage and, you know, all of these sort of musical heroes of mine. So I tried to work in the music industry, and I got I had a musician who was a boyfriend. On the day we finished university, we decided he was just a guitarist, a singer-songwriter. And on the day we finished university, we decided to, it was the night before, so we were a bit drunk. And we decided to, should we stay in Brighton and do gigs over the summer and earn some money to go traveling? Or should we go, I don't know, to Amsterdam? Let's flip a coin, you know. And it was tails, let's go to Amsterdam for the summer and try and earn some money playing in bars. Now, at this point, for some reason, I'd lost all my confidence and I just stopped singing, even though that was something that I wanted to do. And I let him do all the performing. Occasionally, I'd go and do a little bit of backup. But we were performing in bars all over Holland and Belgium, like these big Irish bars, which were just a huge thing at the time. Again, this sort of real history of live music and pubs. And actually, sometimes we were just playing for beer. I mean, we were really, really skint. But there was this incredible community of Irish accented Dutch people who were obsessed with live music, and indeed Ireland, and had all these like quite strong accents. And you'd say, you know, what part are you from? They'd go like, you know, the Netherlands. They'd never even been to Ireland. But it was, again, this really beautiful, beautiful place, you know, very creative and not much money. And we came back having not afforded to go traveling the world with our tails between our legs. But then I did manage to get a job, my first proper job in music, once I got back to Brighton.
I love the use of the word culture and stuff, because if you go back to that era, I mean, the friends you hung out with, the relationship you have, whether they were personal relationships or just friendships and stuff.
Exactly. It was that connection. I went recently to a talk from Irvin Welsh, obviously author of Trainspotting and many other things. And he was talking about how in the 90s, so now I'm back I'm in the UK and in Amsterdam and everything in the 90s, and how that rave culture and dance culture of that time brought people together that became families, you know. And actually those people are still, that I met then in the clubs, are still some of my, you know, my best friends today, you know, the amount of bonding you do over music. And it was to that sort of scene that I came back, well, before I went to Amsterdam as well, but came back and I got a job with a festival at the time called the Essential Festival. It was really big in Sussex, and they used to put on these big festivals in Stanmer Park. It was just called the Essential Festival. And it was the 1999, the year of the eclipse. And they were putting on this big festival with Harvey Goldsmith and who was the other person? I've forgotten. Another big promoter, but Harvey Goldsmith was the main guy, main company as well. And the Essential Festival. And I was tasked, along with my friend Sarah, of doing the press for all the festival. So then we got involved in like the music press, you know, when we were like phoning up NME and Melody Maker and, you know, all the dance music press at the time, because it had a really heavy dance and roots vibe to it. Probably a little bit out of Harvey Goldsmith's comfort zone, because he's used to more doing more mainstream, you know, rock and pop. And
sorry, how old were you then?
So I was about 25, actually. 25, yeah.
But I mean, you kind of started at the top with Harvey Goldsmith.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. No, that was my first job it was really lucky. In fact, I just walked into the office of Ish, the very charismatic owner of Essential Festival, who still is a formidable character. And I walked into their office and said, "Have you got any jobs going?" He's like, "Can you start now?" And I was like, "Okay." And that's kind of how it went with Ish. But he was really, really lovely, warm person, with a hard exterior, but really, really lovely, warm person. And so we'd have to go up to, you know, to the offices in Camden with Harvey Goldsmith. Harvey would be there. And he, you know, is quite an intimidating character for your first job in music. And then the festival is actually quite a bad, not a, a positive story, because it really failed, as did all the Eclipse festivals. I have no idea why, but people just didn't buy tickets. I did go there and I, you know, went through with it all. I was meeting all these amazing people. At the time, the acts that were there were lots of dance music DJs and roots people, like I said. But I was meeting all these amazing band managers, including a wonderful man called Jake. Jake was managing the Rolling Stones at the time, and also for a long time managed Wham when we went, like when they're really big, like went to Japan. I'm sure he's still around there. I don't know if he remembers me. And there were people, managers, all these excellent bands, and it was really good to be a part of it. And so the festival didn't go well, but I did a really good job. I worked my ass off, you know, worked for like 24 hours a day on site and looked after all the press, looked after all the management, looked after all the artists. So Jake said to me, he said, we've got another freelance job directly with Harvey in a couple of months' time. Do you want to come and work on it? And I was like, yes, please. And that led to my biggest rock and roll moment, which was working backstage at Wembley.
So you must have met a lot of artists and stuff. And obviously, like I said before, I can feel the passion at this end. Do you feel that what you went on to do for the remainder of your career, you learned a lot from your time in the industry? I mean, even that admission of I've started as, I mean, everyone starts as, I mean, I was a bass player, but I was like a lousy bass player. So just tell me a little bit more.
Well, I'm a professional talker, so it's kind of taken me a while to get to that point, but I am a professional talker. I've been really fortunate to meet lots of well-known and interesting people during my time as a journalist, but actually music and including musicians, but musically, probably the peak of that was this gig that we did backstage for Harvey Goldsmith. So Jake brought me on as artist liaison assistant, and this was a massive undertaking by Harvey and team that seems to have been forgotten by so many people. So it wasn't Live 8, which I did go to. It was something called Netode. And I don't know if you remember that, but I occasionally speak to a couple of people, go, I was there. Nobody talks about it. It was ahead of its time. So it was just September of 1999. And Harvey and other people, of course, got together to, I think it was five massive concerts around the world to perform at them at the same time and them to be on the internet. So that's when we called it, NetAid. That was the name. So I was doing the artist liaison assistant for the Wembley gig. So I was backstage at Wembley and I'm looking at the list of the artists coming and I'm thinking, oh my God, this is big. David Bowie, Rolling Stones, Bush were coming over from the States, the Eurythmics, Robbie Williams, just like huge, huge acts of the time. And it was when I'm sort of like getting everything ready. There's a lot of pressure because I also had to get the people introducing the acts on. So were people like, I remember Goldie actually particularly because he got stuck in traffic and I had to talk him in and he stole someone's bike and with permission. And it was very funny. But Angelica Houston and Robbie did one, Robbie Williams. And so I David Ginola, so Ronan Keating, I had to get all, Catherine Zeta-Jones as well. I spent a lot of time with her. And I had to get these people sort of backstage and everything. At the same time, I'm suddenly realizing that there's some music coming from stage and it's David Bowie sound checking. And I'm like, oh my God, shivers. I'm backstage at Wembley and Bowie is out there sound checking. Probably the two pinnacle standout moments I remember from that. Many, many moments, but Angelica Houston was coming to introduce David Bowie on stage because they had lots of famous people introducing the acts. And she hadn't met him before. So I had to take Angelica to meet David Bowie. And I took her up there, knocked on David Bowie's dressing room door, and somebody else opened the door. But then he came quickly behind and he's like, oh, hi. And of course, they recognize each other. He knows what she looks like. And so I had to introduce basically, effectively, Angelica Houston to David Bowie.
Love it. You've been listening to Lisa Francesca Nand. Stories about being a lousy, failed musician. We've all been there and done that. And of course, time with Harvey Goldsmith and the like. Great storyteller. Love it. We'll be back with more from Lisa after this.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Thank you.
And then there was another point when I was like standing in the backstage bar and I'm like, that's Mick Jagger. You know, I'm standing next to Mick Jagger, who in person just looks like a caricature of himself because he's so well known and he's got these incredible features, you know. So I'm standing there in the bar with David Bowie, Mick Jagger, Annie Lennox, Robbie Williams, just these people that were just, you know, Dave Stewart, all these people that were just huge and there. And it was just a really special moment. No iPhones. No, so I've got no photographic memory of this time at all. None at all. No, it was just really, really special. It was a great gig and it's a shame. If anyone remembers it or even worked on it, let me know, because it was just it was a success. But again, maybe because of the internet was in its infancy, you know, it just didn't get the post publicity that it should have done. Live 8 was the next one, which I was at as well.
That's insane with a lineup like that. You know, I mean, if you mentioned David Bowie and Rolling Stones, what else do you have to say?
Well, exactly. Yeah. But people were there. People were physically there. I need to look it up. There must be something on it online. But actually, then in terms of my career in music, although I've worked and interviewed with a lot of musicians since, I accidentally took a job that day because I really needed the money. And this is a story for many freelance creatives, including musicians and journalists and all the freelance creatives, is that sometimes you get an offer a job for money and it takes you off in a direction that you'd rather not have gone to. And backstage with Jake, a friend of his came backstage and he offered me a job doing a big corporate event for Disneyland Paris. And I speak French and I was going to be, you know, in charge of getting these huge floats ready for the Millennium Parade. They were producing them in London with a London-based company and then driving them down to Paris, which is a whole other story because it all went terribly wrong. There were accidents, there were bands of gypsies. I had to get people out of prison in my A-level French. But eventually it was a success. But I ended up working in corporate events. And I'm like, damn, you know, this is not... It's really good, but it's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to be back in music. And actually, eventually, how I got back into that sort of, you know, excitement and more glamorous side was instead of working in music events after about 3 or 4 years of this accidental job I took, which was great, was glamorous. It was traveling the world. I was working, you know, doing the after party for the BAFTAs and lots of really interesting events, but it didn't give me that sort of same buzz that music did. And actually, I was going back to I chose to go back to university to train to be a journalist to sort of get me back into that thing, although never directly as a music event producer again.
I'm getting the feel from just talking to you and looking at you, you know, this is great. I love doing the side by side. It's like a fireside chat, you know. I'm getting the feel that you learnt the hustle through the music business. Now, I always say to people, we're all hustlers, but it's how you hustle.
I absolutely did. I have learnt to hustle and I really have to hustle. And I'm a single mum, you know, on a freelance journalist's income. And I do have to hustle and I still have to hustle now. And I think one of the things that working in music and in any creative industry like that teaches you is how to communicate with people at this level. So I've had to, you know, speak to all sorts of big celebrities, you know, now different ones, you know, MPs, comedians, authors, journalists, politicians, you know, you name it, I speak to anyone. And I think that sort of early experience in the music industry did, you know, give me the confidence to just realize that actually these people, they might be like music gods, but they're just people at the end of the day.
I love that. Absolutely, just people. What I was going to say was I always found that the biggest artists were the easiest to work with. I mean, having worked with Bowie myself, they realize it's not all about them. It's about assembling a team of people around you, building a culture, relationships. For me to work with David Bowie was like the equivalent of being knighted. But the point is that I don't think until later on you sit back and kind of appreciate it. It's that gratitude.
But actually that just sort of takes me back to we're talking about Hyde Park and back to Harvey Goldsmith. And when they did do what the official the actual official that people think it was follow-up to Live Aid, it was Live 8. Do you remember that in Hyde Park? I'm guessing it was 8. Was it 2008? I'm guessing that was why it was 8. I'm not quite sure. Or maybe there was 8 gigs, or yeah, I can't remember.
Maybe it was just for 8-year-olds.
Maybe it was just for 8. It felt like we're 8 at the time. It was so it was really incredible. And I managed to sort of blag my way backstage with a few of my connections and, you know, see, I think The Who were playing. And I think actually didn't Pink, I think Pink Floyd got together for that one, which was just, you know, incredible. I've got Dave Gilmour lives down the road from me now.
Really?
So he's occasionally, yeah, he just lives down the road here at Hove. Yeah.
You know him?
No,
he's always welcome on here, you know.
Yeah. I'm very tempted. I do know somebody who's is higher, his manager, but I'm very tempted to try and ask. If I saw him, believe me, I'd ask him.
Yeah.
And actually also, you know, because my brother's a musician and he plays with some very well-known people, he's connected to him. So I feel like I could start a conversation if I ever see him out there walking his dog. And apparently he is out there walking his dog occasionally. But no, sadly, I've never seen him. But they played at Live 8, and that was another, you know, massive musical moment. But since then, apart from interviewing, you know, musicians for my podcast, and I, you know, I do get a few coming through. Alex Kapranos from Franz Ferdinand I had on recently. He was amazing. And then some sort of newer, so Nina Nesbitt and Freya Ridings, you know, some really good new artists coming out. Well, they're big now, actually, but not those sort of old, big old names that we're talking about. So I do get to work with them. But, you know, music, I think, just I just get really excited. And one thing that I kind of learned, and I think, and what I love about you is you get this too. You get sometimes people who maybe in the beginning stroke middle of their careers who get really snotty about the work they do. They're like, oh yeah, whatever. And actually there was this one woman, a tour manager or a band manager that I was working with on that first job with Harvey Goldsmith for the Eclipse Festival. And I remember she was managing a big band at the time. And I was like, you know, I was like, oh, that's really exciting. That's great. You know, what is it like? Is it really good managing this big band? And she was like, yeah, it's fine. You know, like I was some sort of like stupid little girl. And actually, you know, however many years, 30 years later, I'm still that wise-eyed little girl, because I feel that it's great to be excited by it. It's great to, you know, be excited by these people who mean something to you, or to create amazing things, you know, whether that's the shopkeeper that you interact with in the morning or David Bowie. You know, it's really good to still be excited. And I use that in my travels as well, because, you know, everyone loves holidays. Most people love holidays and traveling, and you relax and see things in a new way. But I try and do that with my hometown. You know, I try the new coffee shop, walk down the back streets, look up at the buildings, you know, go and sit on the beach with that coffee and do all those things that you do on holiday. You know, take that feeling with you and never, ever lose that wide-eyed passion for things. That's how I try and live my life.
It's so funny. I mean, God, it must be close on a year since you had me on your podcast. And I remember this moment vividly. At the end of us talking, I was like, oh, you know, like blah, 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 blah. You know? And I said, I'm sorry. You know, at the end, it was the compulsory apology. I said to you, oh, I'm sorry, Lisa, I fly off at tangents and things. But you know what? I don't want to lose that excitable child. You leant into the screen and said, Tony, I love that. And your face lit up. And I wasn't trying to impress you, but it was like the passion that is within. Now, tell me this. I'm very cynical at certain times about musicians. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of the time they're all insecure and needy. They don't trust a lot of people, you know. But I do feel that what you learnt as, dare I be as brutal as to say, a failed musician, been there, done that. Your brother, right, Harvey Goldsmith, in the same room as Bowie and Jagger. You know, you were not a lucky girl, but you were a privileged girl in as much as you earned it, right? But do you find that being a journalist, writing about and talking to these people, subliminally, those years in your youth, whatever, growing up and stuff, do you feel those really helped you in front of a musician? Because they're really suspicious as journalists. Because a lot of the time, and I know for a fact it's happened from my many years in the industry, where you can sit with a guy, a girl, whatever, have a beer with them in a pub for 50 minutes or something, and sometimes they'll pick up that one thing where you fucked up on.
Yeah.
You said something you shouldn't have done. And it's a headline. It's a headline. Mm. And I find that a bit tacky, because you just want sensationalism.
I think it was a magical time and period. Of course, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s as well. Even the bands from the 90s and the early 2000s. And I do try my best to keep up with new music. I really do. But music is so ubiquitous everywhere, to buy it everywhere these days, which makes it more accessible. But it doesn't give that sort of special status to those key artists who really managed to stand out from the crowds. And I think to have those people, you know, the Bowies, the Mick Jaggers, the Madonnas, the Chers, even like into the 80s, the Kylie Minogues, you know, and then later on, the really big bands of the 90s and early 2000s, you know, I think to have those iconic people, it was a really, they were special decades. You know, it was a long period of time, but they were special decades. And you do get people now, you get people, the people that my kids admire are YouTubers, you know, they're people playing games online. Those special people are still there. They've just changed direction. But to live in, you know, wow, what a time to have been a music fan and to have worked, you know, alongside, even for a little bit. You know, in the decades that you've had more decades than me. And, you know, in terms of that, you had the 70s, I was born in the 70s. But what a time, you know, we have been really privileged. And I think it really is important to see, you know, to really appreciate that. Whilst I said that, I don't want to get like on the bad side of it, but there's also like some dodgy things that these musicians, you know, did, you know, but I know it was a different period. So, you know, while I do idolize them, and I've been very, very lucky to, you know, to have met some of my idols, you know, I do acknowledge that it's for another time, you know, but there were things that, you know, that people did back in those days that would be, you know, rightly frowned upon now. It hasn't always been golden, but they are still icons.
But I find, you know, from where I came from, you know, like you say, it was a different time and a different place. But I do feel that you kind of grow into something like that. In those days, the industry was run by people who signed artists that could be in the record collection. My grooming was through the Chris Blackwells, the Armored Ertigans. I worked with A&M, you know, with Herb Alpert and Jerry Moss. It's now satisfying shareholders and the corporate infrastructure. My kind of favourite topic in my career was artist development. And I heard you kind of go into that.
The other thing I should tell you about when you've got more time, but I should tell you about the 1990s scene that I was involved with in Brighton, because I was like doing a lot of stuff on the local radio here, but I was working in the clubs as well. But it was when like Norman Cook, Fatboy Slim formed Skint Records with my friend Damien. And that was like another sort of, that's one of your moments that rock as well.
And there you have it. Don't you love people's stories from inside the industry? You've been listening to Lisa Francesca Nand. This is Moments That Rock. I'm Tony Michaelides. We're part of the Pantheon Group of podcasts. Enjoy the festive season and we will see you next week. Subscribe, enjoy, tell your friends and come back for more.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.